On to that actually. So Bernie, I'm just officially going to welcome you now to
Okay.
just had a nice chat, officially welcome you to the Talk On to Walk On podcast.
Thank you.
I can't help but dive straight in. I have to dive straight in and ask you about your recent, most recent, incredible, grueling, epic adventure across the Atlantic. How are you feeling right now? When did you get back, and how are you mentally and physically?
Right. Okay. Well, got back a few weeks ago from Antigua, which was the finish line of the actual row. Rode just over well, it was 3,500 miles in total, over 109 days. How do I feel now? That's a really great question, Michelle. Yeah, I'm starting to recover. I lost 2.5 stone in weight, which was a huge amount of weight to lose. So I'm starting to gain weight back again, which is great. Physically, I've still got a few bits and bobs I've got to sort out. I've got a busted knee, which happened on the boat with a major accident that happened. So I can talk to you about that a bit later. So I've got to get my knee sorted out. Mentally, just starting to get my head around being at home again, which is just absolutely delightful. Just it's great being back. My value system has basically been altered whilst I've been rowing across the Atlantic tremendously. I now value things now more than ever before, particular sort of family, the basic things in life that you have, which I never had on the boat. So it's amazing to be alive, with regards to what I went through. Great to be back, and I'm looking forward to the next chapter,
I
whatever
agree.
that is.
What a line. It's amazing to be alive. And it's actually very pertinent, isn't it, Bernie? It wasn't just because you went solo across 3,000 miles in a boat, not much bigger than a van, I'm guessing. I don't know the size of it, but that's the
Yeah,
images
so 7 meters long. It was 20 foot long.
Yes. And it actually did capsize. You did hit some stormy weather a couple of times, I believe, but
Yeah,
one was scary.
we had the worst weather in the history of the race. So in the 10 years of the race, it's been the worst weather storms and depressions, low depressions that they've ever seen. So my boat and a number of other boats in the fleet, we went through 17 storm systems in 109 days. So a storm system is an Atlantic storm whereby you get force 10 gale. You only get about 30 to 40 foot waves. So these are humongous waves coming up at you. And then the roar and the sound, the rain is coming in on a vertical point of view as well. And it's just like it is hell on earth, to be fair. And there's no other way you can explain it. And then you either have to either row through it or you either have to hunker down in your front cabin, which is the size of a telephone box, and you seal a hatch. And then basically you sit and pray that you're not obviously going to get capsized, which sadly I did on a number of occasions. The boat capsized underneath the water on a few of those storms with horrendous circumstances on the second one.
Okay, are you happy to talk about it, or is it still a
Yeah.
little? I don't want to take you
No,
red
you.
though yet, because clearly, you know, it's clearly a huge life-changing moment for you.
Yeah, it's. I think when the first one happened, the boats has got great technology in it. So these boats are built to go across the ocean, and they're built to rewrite, just like a lifeboat. So when a lifeboat gets tossed over, it will bob back up again. So it's got that rewriting technology built into the boat itself. But on the first capsize, which happened in the storm, the boat did go over quite gently. The wave hit it, and basically she went over. Everything basically was chaos in the cabin because everything went upside down. Lights went off. Equipment went everywhere. And basically, you hope and pray that it's going to come back up again. Thankfully, within a minute or two, the boat really bobbed back up really quickly, which was fantastic in the middle of the storm. I couldn't get out to actually put an anchor out because even though you are in the mid-Atlantic, you could still put an anchor out to actually stop the boat from actually capsizing. And it's not a physical anchor that you'd push off the side of a boat and it would go down and hit the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean because it's 5 miles deep. It's a huge parachute. So it's like a parachute that you jump out an aircraft with. That's how big it is. So you actually have to deploy this parachute that then sinks into the water. and fills up with water, 3 tons of water, and it actually stops the boat from moving forward. But more importantly, it points the boat into the actual head of the waves. So as opposed to the boat being beam on, as it's called, and the waves are hitting you on the side, the boat basically turns and you have the front of the pointy bit of the boat, the bow, basically pointing the waves as they're coming towards you. So there's less opportunity for the boat to capsize if you've got the parachute out, the para anchor. Fortunately, I didn't have time to do that on this storm because it just came out of nowhere. And on the second capsize, which happened 30 minutes later, I got hit with a wave, which was, they call it a rogue wave, which was a huge force. And it came in at such pace. It belted the side of the boat at such a force that the boat literally capsized within milliseconds. And the boat got hammered that much that when the boat went over, all of the equipment in the boat basically came out of the hatches. And there's heavy equipment underneath where I was sitting in a hatch, which basically fell out and crushed my legs. So when it happened, the capsize basically happened out of nowhere. The lights went black because it blacked out the electricity because the batteries got damaged. And I was sitting in the dark with all of this equipment on my legs in massive pain with a storm going on. I was upside down at this time. I can see all of the water on the hatch trying to come in. Water started to ingress into the hatch. So I could see water flowing through to the hatch itself. The boat didn't be right. So I'm sitting there, lights off, storm going on, hearing this horrendous noise and crashing of waves outside. The boat's upside down. You can see the water coming through the hatch. After around about 3 minutes, I thought, right, this boat's not going to come up and there's no way I can open up the hatch because of the pressure. The water's coming in. And I thought, I think this is it. So I made a phone call to my friend, Tim, and I rang him. It was 3 o'clock UK time. So I know nobody would answer. Everybody was in bed. So I called Tim and I said goodbye to my family, my partner, all my two sons. And I said, you know, if I don't come back from this, I just want to say thank you for everything. Thank you for an amazing life. Take care of yourselves. And really, that was it. Put the phone down. And I just basically just sat there in the dark. And coincidentally, I'm not a man of faith. Before I went on my trip, one of my neighbors, who is a Christian, gave me a little wooden cross, so it's about that size. I've got it here, actually. I brought it home with me. And he said, take it with you, and God will be with you. And I thought, yeah, okay, because I respect everybody's faith. And I said, right, thank you. That's so kind of you. Thank you. And he said, if you turn the cross around, he said, it's got the ocean waves in it, so it was made for you personally. So he said, take it with you, and he'll look after you. And I said, okay, no problem. Thank you. And coincidentally, when I got capsized, believe it or not, and this is as true as I'm sitting here, the cross fell out of where I had actually perched it in the cabin and fell into my hand. So I was holding onto this little piece of wood in the dark. I'd made the phone call thinking, well, okay, fella, if you want to come and help me, now's the time to really help me out here. I really need your help. And I prayed. You know, I think, you know, please God, get me out of this, whatever you're doing, you know, try and basically get the boat back up. And it didn't go back up. So around about 5 minutes had gone past, the water started to come into the cabin. So I was preparing for the worst, and just the boat started to just move ever so slightly, just a slight jerk it was. And I was thinking, right, okay, this may be coming back up. And slowly but surely, after about 4 or 5 minutes, after the 5 minutes had been there, the boat started to turn around and come back up again. And thankfully, it actually re-righted itself in the storm. Now, at this stage, outside of the actual boat itself, attached to it, is a beacon which sends off an emergency signal to the UK Coast Guard that coordinates all of the worldwide rescues for people that are lost at sea. So the signal had already gone off to the Coast Guard, and they'd already got a boat, the nearest boat, to actually come and rescue me. It was on its way, even within the 5 minutes of being capsized. And so that boat was on it en route to me. So I knew that when I rewrite it, I needed to make a call to our control to say, please stop the boat from coming. I'm rewrited. I'm okay. I'll get the boat sorted out. I'll get all the water out. I'll get myself sorted out within the next few hours. So I made that call, spoke to control. They said, are you okay to carry on? I said, yeah, I think I am. I think my legs are okay, but I won't know till I've obviously got the equipment off it. So they stopped the rescue from happening. The boat came back up in the storm. Storm lasted for around about another 5 hours. The storm subsided. I was then had a chance to clear the boat and get the boat back into a good position to row again. My legs were fairly badly damaged. I had to ring the race doctor because one of the legs was crushed. And he did an examination over the telephone. And he said, I think there might be ligament damage in your knee. So let's see how you get on for the next few days. Don't row with that leg, row with the left leg and your two arms, and let's see how you get on. So that's what I did. Subsequently, the leg has got damage. I was going to the hospital in the next few days to get it x-rayed and get it examined, and it's causing me great concern now. But at the time when I was in the boat, I couldn't stand up on it. It was that bad. So I continued the row with one leg and rowed across the Atlantic 3,500 miles with one leg and two arms. And
so it was near the beginning of the...
Yeah, it was. It was the first week of the row. And I thought, I'm out of this. And I'm thinking, I've got another 3,000 miles to go now. And I've got to do it with one leg.
Your mental resilience must be off the scale.
Only
about what you've just gone through. But even if you just had a damaged leg to do that without the mental impact of the life-changing moment that you've just so eloquently shared. And thank you for that. I feel very privileged. I feel a little bit teary, if you don't mind me saying, because you described it so vividly. And obviously it's still so fresh.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was literally only about 3 months ago now.
Yeah, and you talk about faith, and we all have our different beliefs. And I've heard you talk about your mum. She was quite religious, wasn't she? Did you you've lost both your mum and dad. Did you think about them in that moment?
Well, I think about them every day, Michelle. I mean, you know when you have special loved ones that you really make an impact on your life? Mm-hmm. You carry them around wherever you are. Now, the great thing about the Boat of Hope, which is the campaign that we've been running around this row, because this row is just a third of what we've been doing. Yeah. My mum and dad feature on the boat. So I've got my mum and dad's picture on the boat with me in their arms when I was a baby. But mum and dad were just absolutely incredible. I lost them 40 odd years ago due to cancer and emphysema. And they were hugely influential in my life. I came from a council estate in Liverpool called Speke. And we didn't really have a lot of money, which I didn't really know at the time. I thought we were the richest folks on the planet, really, because we had an amazing family, hugely religious, Catholic, Irish Catholic family. My dad was Irish. And, you know, we went to mass, you know, on a Sunday. We went to benediction on a Wednesday, and we did all the holy days and confession. And even if I didn't sin, I had to make sins up when I went into the confession box. So
I remember those days.
Michelle. So, but mum was brilliant. I mean, mum didn't have anything, but she gave everything she had away. At the time, I didn't really get it. I didn't really understand why she was doing this and why she was helping others in the way that she did. And she was in the Union of Catholic Mothers, and all the Catholic mums used to get together in Speak, basically just do great things like WI and so on and so forth. And she was the love of my life. I just worshipped the ground she walked on. She was just such an incredible, wise individual. That really she shaped me, and I think it's within my DNA really effectively to give. And she always said to me that, you know, to give is to receive. And if you give everything that you have to everybody, you'll get so much back in return. And it's been so true, 63 years on the planet. And those words resonate with me every single day. My mum is just, she's with me now. And also my great dad, Paddy, because we named the boat the City of Liverpool in honor of my father and my grandfather. And because they spent their working lives in the Liverpool docks. My dad sailed out of Liverpool. And my granddad was a docker in the Liverpool all of their working lives. And, you know, I just wanted to do something for them, to give something back to them. And I spoke to them every single day on the boat. And, you know, and hopefully they were listening to me wherever they are. I think there is an after place that spirits go. But yeah, mum and dad were just so influential in my life.
I love that. That, again, a lovely story, highly relatable, having come from, you know, a Catholic myself. And both Patrick and I have lost our mums. Well, we both lost our both parents, but Patrick in particular, you may pick up on this, but I know he was in about, I'm guessing you're in your 20s. Patrick was in his 20s.
Exactly the same time Patrick lost his,
So we, you know, we're all hail the mums, you know, and it is incredible how they just stay with you. Again, I was nodding away and I just have conversations with my mum still every day. You know, it's nuts, isn't it? The impact.
It is. But do you know what? It's great for your mental wellness.
Yeah.
You know? People think that, you know, if you talk to yourself or you're talking to somebody, they think you're crazy. But I think those days are going. You know, when you talk, you know, when talking to a spirit or talking to a person that you believe and you loved is one of the best therapies you can have. Particularly when you're trying to problem solve, you know, hey mum, you know, what would you do in this situation?
Absolutely.
You know, and
isn't it interesting how you can hear their answer?
Oh yeah.
But it's you really telling yourself what you should do, because it's you're hearing it in their voice, it's like it gives you permission to do it.
In one, Michelle, absolutely.
It's like, oh, my mum said it's all right.
Mum said it's all right, so I'm going to do it now.
Absolutely. So that really, so your mum's giving in particular set the foundation for you as a giving person, clearly. Yeah,
she did.
Yeah. And in terms of, I know, understand that one of the first things you did, I read that you ran a marathon. That was one of your first.
Yeah, the family, when mum passed, we decided as four brothers, I've got three other great brothers that I love to bits. My three brothers and I decided to run a marathon. Now that was 40 plus years ago. Yeah. Marathon running was just in its infancy, you know? So we ran, it was the Piccadilly Marathon, Radio Piccadilly in Manchester. We ran the Piccadilly Marathon, and well, we said we ran it. Actually, we walked all of it. Really. 7 hours. We did that in aid of mum, and we raised a small amount of money. But when I finished the marathon with Steve, Mark, and John, I just got such a feeling of satisfaction of doing something for somebody else. And we raised a few bob for a great charity, which was obviously cancer related. And I thought that was the start of my really adventure career, really, when I started to think about how can I raise funds for charities doing adventuring and doing marathon? Because I became a bit of a marathon nut, to be fair. You know, I've ran over 150 marathons in that period of time. I hold the world record for the longest distance ran in 7 days. I ran from Johnny Blows to Land's End 3 times.
I have to say, I've just got this image of Forrest Gump, if you don't mind me saying. I've been given that analogy.
It was. When I ran from John O'Groats to Land's End, I got so many people coming running with me. Because it,
really? Again,
yeah, honestly, yeah, because it was on local radio all the way down. Yeah. So, you know, the local radio folks would say, if you want to come and join Bernie for a bit of his run today, because I did 2 marathons every day for 20 days nonstop. So it was... Yeah, it was 41 consecutive marathons in 20 days. And so it's just over 56 miles every day for 21 days it was. And then I finished it with the London Marathon. And it was just great fun. I had an amazing team with me. Because everywhere I go, I have great people up behind me. I mean, the theme of actually doing things on your own, you don't never, ever, ever successful on your own. You always have an amazing group of folks behind you. And I've been blessed over the last 40 years to have an incredible group of people that come together to just do, just make the magic happen. I'm fortunately sort of the front guy that gets basically doing amazing things like this with you, Michelle, but it's the people in the background that really make the magic happen.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely, one thing you definitely advocate for is community and collaboration. And obviously, like you say, with all these adventures and challenges, you can't do on your own, even though, like you say, you tend to, you get the glory at the end, but with the it's the team, isn't it? It's the coming together. And again, the connections, communication, conversation, building each other up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge. It is. I mean, they say, you know, teamwork makes the dream work, and it's so true. I mean, it really just makes the dreams come to life, really.
Yeah.
And without those collaborative efforts of people coming around, you wouldn't make things happen. It's just simply impossible. So our latest project, The Boat of Hope, has just been a phenomenal success from start to finish, with the most amazing creative people I could have ever dreamed of that have come on board to make it happen. Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So you had incredible artists, didn't you, to do the mural around?
We commissioned an artist called Justin Eagleton.
Yeah.
And if any of the viewers or listeners want to go to have a look at his work, it's justineagleton.com.
Yeah.
Just an incredible artist. Not only he actually does normal art, but he also does digital art as well. And that's where he and I basically sat down 2 years ago and put this incredible 42-foot mural together, which actually shows a young person going through depression on one side of the boat. So 22 foot of the mural is the depression side. And then that's wrapped around the hope side, which shows the individual coming out with hope, support, care, love. And we went out to 10,000 school kids and asked them the question, what does hope mean to you? And the result was this mural. So we got all of these entries in, which were just truly remarkable. And we had to choose 6 winners to get their artwork onto the boat. But we had so many incredible phrases, works of art, images that we said, right, okay, let's see if we can put a beautiful montage onto a mural, and then we'll wrap it around the boat, which is seen by over 950 million people around the world.
And what a message. So it wasn't just your solo effort. And so that, I mean, that gets the headlines.
Yeah,
but absolutely. The messaging that you took with you is the key. Underpinning your why and keeping you going, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
you're wrapped in it.
What's that, Michelle?
You're literally physically wrapped in your why.
Yeah, I was, you know, people said to me, did I get down? Did I get depressed? Well, I did, but I had to get off the boat on a regular basis to clean the bottom of the boat. So for people that aren't nautical, when you actually have a boat in the water, it gets an awful lot of debris underneath the boat. And particularly when you go across the ocean, you get barnacles growing on the bottom, because barnacles love hulls of boats because they flow through the water and then they get the nutrients from the plankton as you go through. Mm-hmm. So you get a huge amount of barnacles, thousands of these things, creatures just attach themselves to the bottom of the boat, but they slow the boat down.
Okay.
So it's like the aerodynamics is basically it's dragged through the water. So every couple of weeks you have to get off with a scraper and you have to scrape the bottom of the boat to get all of these barnacles off. So every 2 weeks I got off and I was just looking at the, you know, I had to go all the way around the boat. And obviously I see everybody looking at me, but over 2,000 faces looking at me.
Love it.
And, you know, I've even got Murphy, my dog, on there as well.
Yeah.
And my partner, Sharon, as well. So when I did that, it just lifts you. But also it reminded me about what we were doing. I mean, the Boat of Hope campaign was started 2 years ago because within our family, and this affects every family in the United Kingdom, depression and suicidal thoughts have affected some of my family members in the past. And when we started this campaign, I sat down with a very, very special young man and said, you know, really, how can we stop this from happening in the future? How can we stop young children taking their lives? Because last year in the UK alone, 370 young people aged 11 to 18 took their life to suicide. And that is criminal. It really, really is. It is criminal. The government have got to do something about this. And I'll talk to you about a very, very special relay that's coming up in June of this year, which everybody needs to know about. We'll talk about that in a second. So I sat down with this amazing young man, and we decided that if we could get to young people really early on in life, and we were talking about 5 to 18, and we could get those young people to start talking about how they feel inside their heads and hearts, we just may be able to stop them from going into a full-blown anxiety or depression and then suicidal tendencies. So we did some research with the mental health agencies that we've been working with, Mind, Samaritans, Palparis, and a number of other agencies. One amazing agency in Liverpool that I will give a shout out for is Jake Mills and the Hub of Hope.
Yeah.
And Jake is just one incredible man who's put an incredible resource together, which when you are feeling anxious or you're feeling depressed and you need to get help, you actually don't have to go to your GP. You can actually go to the Hub of Hope, put your postal code in, and it will actually bring up all of the local support groups for your depression online. So we spoke to all of those folks, and they said, right, well, a really clever way of actually getting a conversation going with a young person is not just by having a conversation. It's actually by asking them to draw a picture or write down what they feel. So we thought, right, let's use the creative arts in our campaign to open up that conversation. And that's what we've done. Yeah. And that's why we reached out to 10,000 high school students in 6,500 schools. The boat has been around the whole of the United Kingdom. June of last year, we took the boat to 50 high schools and 50 primary schools around the United Kingdom, talking about mental health, talking about suicidal thoughts with the elder students. With the younger students, we were talking about mental wellness with Bernie and Boaty, the book. And it was just a huge success. The amount of teachers and the amount of students that said, this is the first time I've actually started talking about how I feel in here. And, you know, your campaign and the exercises that we've done when we go around the schools have really started to facilitate that conversation for the first time. So we're hugely proud of what we've achieved. I mean, we've raised awareness, but we've also raised a heap of money as well for mental health agencies as well.
And it's the Samaritans, isn't it, that have done the reporting to young, the impact of, in particular, the pandemic, I think, on youth mental health, and that they're looking into the links into loneliness, because the world has changed significantly again.
Absolutely.
I mean, again, that's a whole separate debate and topic, but without a doubt, resources need to be put towards this. And it seems incredible that we have to ask for it, but this is the culture we're living in right now, isn't it?
It is. I think that if you go back 10 years, that there's a huge stigma about mental health. It was seen as a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
You know, the normal phrase is man up, pull yourself together. What you think you're doing? Get on with it. That was appropriate 10, 15 years ago when we didn't really understand what was going on up here. Mm-hmm. And now, thankfully, due to the amazing agencies that we've got and the amazing people that are doing great things out there, like Three Dads Walking, for example, Papyrus, Minds, Samaritans. We've got an amazing initiative coming up with Mike McCarthy and Steve Phillips.
Yeah.
They're actually doing the Baton of Hope.
Yeah, I've seen that. He's been on the BBC this week, and I've approached them with a view to getting Mike on as well. Bring it on. I'm happy to just provide the platform to get these help get these messages out, you know.
Well, you know that those guys have actually suffered suicides very, very close to them. Yeah. Their daughters and their sons have passed away through suicide. Mm-hmm. And what those guys are doing is just absolutely incredible. And I think that, you know, the pendulum is starting to swing. And I think Three Dads Walking are actually seeing the Prime Minister this afternoon, fingers crossed. And their focus is not money. They just want to basically put suicide awareness training into high schools.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Yeah. It's basically saying to kids, listen, you're not on your own. You may think you're on your own, but please start talking about how you feel. I took a teddy bear with me on the boat. It sounds a bit bonkers, this, but...
You are bonkers, Bernie, and that's... not as bonkers as half of the other stuff you've done.
No, I guess not. But you know, Tom Hanks had Wilson, the ball with the hand on it. Well, I had A.B. Bear, and A.B. Bear is a very, very special bear. He is the mascot and the actual figurehead for the Royal Air Force Mental Health Charity. And it's just been launched. It's called Bear Force. It's an incredible charity all about this teddy bear. And this teddy bear gets young people to start talking about how they feel inside their heads and hearts. And there's a lovely book that goes with the charity as well. Huge shout out to my great friend, Richard Bland, who again sadly lost his son, Drew, over 10 years ago to suicide, and decided to start this incredible charity up with this little teddy bear. And this teddy bear is just going to do amazing things. I can't tell you what's happening in the future, but really exciting plans are happening for Richard. And you'll see this bear on a very, very big national airline shortly as their mascot. And it's just incredible. So Richard asked me to take AB with me on my journey across the Atlantic. And I said, I'd be honored. So this little teddy bear came with me, and I'm glad I had him actually, because I would have gone crazy if I hadn't spoken to AB every day. Mm-hmm. And it really shows that it really is good to talk. And we touched on it before, Michelle, that, you know, we reached out to our late mums and we talked to mum, you know, in the ether. But having somebody there to actually talk to and for the bear to listen, because listening is a great skill, really got me through, to be honest with you, as well. So thank you to Richard Bland and Bear Force Charity. They're just doing fabulous things. And I was absolutely honoured to take that bear with me.
Just what a beautiful story. I'm so exciting. It just sound like the momentum now is really starting to happen, Bernie. You know, all these incredible people are actually not working individually anymore. Yeah. This is truly becoming a real collaboration and force for good together.
Absolutely.
That is exciting.
It is exciting times for mental health. There's so much more to do.
Yeah.
And I think really what we now need to do, and this is where Three Dads Walk In and Steve and Mike are doing amazing things. They're now starting to influence government.
Yeah.
Because we can do what we're doing now. We can raise awareness by doing what we're doing. But if we can actually get governments to come behind, yeah, and start supporting initiatives in schools and making things compulsory. And it's not nanny state stuff, this will save lives.
It's literally creating a new culture of conversation. It sounds, we all talk to each other. We're there, you know, normal. But do we actually, and you touched on it, actually listening?
Mm, absolutely. Well, Mum always said to me, you've got one of those and you've got two of these.
For a reason.
Yeah, half as much of this and twice as much as this. And it's as simple as that. Listen. And, you know, that so many people you touch every day have got so much going on in the background that you don't know. Everybody has a story, okay? And you don't know what story they're carrying around with them. And you come to work and you go into these wonderful situations. You put a face on. You know, it's like you're on stage and you put all your worries behind you when you get into the workplace or you get into school. And really what we need to do is we all have physical well-being. And, you know, our physicality is important to us. So we eat the right food, we exercise, and we do that on a daily basis. We look after ourselves physically, but you also have your mental wellness to look after as well. So you have to exercise your mental well-being as well. And that means doing wellness exercises, listening to calming music, you know, basically doing a yoga class, doing something that really basically gets you in line with making your mind, putting it in a better position. Yeah, absolutely. And not being ashamed to say that I'm depressed or I'm feeling down. Mm. The great British public are very, very good at saying that they're okay when they're not okay. You go to the doctors and the doctor says, well, how are you today? Yeah, I'm fine, doctor. And you go in with an illness. Mm. It's just this tradition that we've all been brought up with that we now need to break that down. And yeah. I always say to everybody, listen, if you're out today or you see somebody today and, you know, and you're passing them by, ask them how they are, you know, and it's incredible. When you start a conversation, people will open up really quickly and tell you how they feel.
Yeah, and if you just give people space and time.
Yeah.
The impact is phenomenal.
Oh, it is, absolutely. It's, Michelle, it saves lives. It really, really, really does, honestly. You think it won't. But if you speak to a stranger and ask them how they are on the bus, or, you know, on the plane or wherever you are, it's a therapy. It's a release. You know, it's the old adage.
It's something I've actually only very recently, and again, my pandemic experience was actually a blessed one. There are a few that I had that chance to pause, but I had never, once I started pausing, reflecting and doing a bit of that self-work, it was incredible how the layers just started to peel. Absolutely. And revealed other things. So, I mean, again, that's a different, a separate conversation, but it is that power of just having a minute. You know, and reflecting just on that point as well, Bernie, just from your personal perspective, it's touching a little nerve at me, and I might be wrong, but you know, you talk about all these marathons and everything that you've done, and it's incredible. Yeah. But what I'm also sensing is, and I know I've been there too, is a massive distraction tactic. Potentially, is there a distraction in there from you opening up, particularly when you were young?
That's a really, really good point. Do you know, I was blessed with having a great family background, and my mental well-being was really, it's been fantastic, to be fair. But, you know, as you go through high school and the pressures from academia start to actually come upon you, you know, it's all about performance related. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In my day, it was called O-levels, the GCSEs now. But, you know, there was obviously a pressure to get to A-levels and get to university and get a degree and then get into, you know, a really serious job. But mum always said to me, you're not going to see like your dad, and you're not going to be doing what I'm doing. I want you to go out and get an education, because she said, the more that you learn, the more that you earn. And she rammed that down my throat virtually from day one. And she made sure I did my homework and I got additional coaching and lessons and so on and so forth. I was actually quite fortunate, really, when I got to a stage whereby I could start doing these things. You know, all of my family were usually supportive around it. And I was quite athletic when I was younger. I was quite a decent runner and decent footballer at the time. So I thought that I could actually, when I did the first marathon in particular, I thought, well, I quite enjoy this, although it was really, really difficult. I think if I could try it a little bit, if I could train a bit better, I could do this much better. So I started running basically based upon that principle. And I quickly found out that the more training I did, the easier the marathons got, and the more enjoyable they became. And at that stage, marathon running was quite unique. You know, there wasn't an awful lot of people doing it at that stage 40 odd years ago. And people gave me lots of money for charities that I believed in. And I got to the stage in my career, in my corporate career, where I was very fortunate enough to actually in Lloyds Banking Group. Lloyds Bank, as it was then, was a very sort of niche bank when it first started. I was fortunate enough to look after the charitable accounts within the organization.
Oh, okay.
And I got to know an awful lot of great people in the charity space. The big girls and boys of charity, all the way down to the small charities. And I had the best job on earth. I mean, my job was to look after them and make them more wealthy.
Yeah, nice.
So I created a charitable product which created an awful lot of money for charities by doing very little, by basically getting customers, retail customers, to actually give fractions of a penny on every transaction that went through their tills to charity. And it raised millions for charity. It raised absolutely millions for charity. But it was a very simple idea, which I found that, you know, you can actually be charitable by using companies and company resource to actually make things happen. And you don't have to give money. So I call it stuff. So in my charitable life, there are three things you can give. You can give time, which is the most precious thing you can give. Yeah. You can give money and you can give the stuff. It's three things. And I lecture on this around the world about how you actually can make charities more successful, because charities are businesses. And if you operate them as a business, they're usually successful if you use the principles of business. Don't run it as a charity whereby you're passionate about stuff, but you actually lose the end game, which is making profit. So I took those principles and I opened up my first charity about 30 years ago now. We started our first charity, and that's now cascaded into three or four charities. And I sit on the boards of many charities in the UK now. which I first started many years ago and very successful. And I'm really proud of using the principles of what I learned in my corporate career, actually bringing that into the third sector. And it's been hugely successful. So one of our charities now is basically more retail than charity and makes a lot of money in retail based upon what we've been doing. So we as in business can't stand still for 2 seconds. It's got to consistently change and change direction to be successful, because otherwise it comes stale. And it, obviously your buying public loses interest in what you do. So, you know, if a clothing shop sell the same clothes every year, it go out of business. So it's exactly the same with charity. Charity has to be dynamic. There has to be a story that goes with the charity. Yeah. The narrative has to go, you know, move on a day-to-day basis. And that's been exacerbated by social media, which tells stories now virtually every second. You get posts from charities about what's happening, and it's just fabulous. It's an amazing space to be in.
Yeah, and you, I can tell you're still really energized by it. I could listen to you for hours, and you can see there's so many different little directions we could go in with this. I'm actually going to bring in Patrick at the moment. Patrick, what have been your thoughts so far on the on Bernie and his incredible stories?
Well, I've absolutely loved listening, and I've got my notes here. I've taken, but I've only got one bit of paper and it's filled up. So, Bernie, when you know, I listen to guys like you who are hugely inspirational, I'm desperately trying to find things that I can say, well, I'm a little bit like him, and I'm, you know, you want to. And when you said you were saying you did your first marathon 40 years ago, and I was thinking, well, that's 1983. I did my first marathon 40 years ago. Actually, I remember it very well, October 1984, and I did the Canterbury Marathon. But the difference between you and me is that I've never done another one. You've done over 100.
You took the sensible route, Patrick.
So I'm deflated there. So, but then, and then the other thing, of course, going back to Lloyds Bank, I did bank with Lloyds Bank was my first bank as a student. I've moved on since then, but my first bank account I ever had was with Lloyds Bank. But Bernie, the fascinating to listen to you, and I love that the phrase that you used, teamwork makes the dream work. I hadn't come across that before, but it's so pithy and great. Just wanted to pick up on a couple of things. I'm reading a book at the moment called Make Your Bed. I don't know if you've read it.
I've read it, yeah.
Yes, by William H. McRaven. So for the benefit of the listeners, he's a retired admiral and an ex-Navy SEAL. And you'll probably remember that one of his chapters is actually called, If You Want to Change the World, Find Someone to Help You Paddle. And when I reread that, I thought, well, Bernie didn't have anybody to help him paddle out in the mid-Atlantic. And it sort of made me start thinking about sort of leadership. And, you know, I've been in the corporate world, well, almost all my career, and I do some leadership mentoring now. But I've got to learn lots of different leadership styles from people that you come across. And it's interesting that it doesn't matter. There are a whole range of leadership styles, and there's no right or wrong. Yeah. And you've talked about, and I think I've read about, I think you have a preference sometimes to lead from the back, but there are some leaders in business that lead from the front or are very, very vocal. But you've also wonderfully talked about your team and how important that team behind the scenes is.
Absolutely.
How do you motivate your team when you're out there rowing by yourself, or you're doing the Marathon des Sables by yourself, or you're doing whatever endeavor it is by yourself, and you've got that team? In the build-up to that event, how do you motivate your team to be behind you and you know, you're leading from the front by yourself?
I read a book many, many years ago called Storytelling is Changing the World, and it's by a great author called Ken Burnett. And it really is it's an amazing book to read, by the way. And it really is all about the story. And if we go back to when we were kids, we always remember mum and dad telling you a story at the bedtime, you know, and they come up and you'd actually bring the story to life. And you then have dreams about that amazing story that your mum or dad actually read to you before you went to sleep. And because your imagination started to go into the book and you became a part of the actual narrative of the book. And when you're in business or when you're in charity or when you're trying to motivate the team, storytelling is absolutely essential. Absolutely. So you've got to get the story right. I always tell people that if you have an amazing story, great things will happen around it. And you won't have to do any selling of it because people will actually come and believe in what you're doing. And I've had some great stories along the way whereby when I've told my story to somebody, particularly when I came up with the Boat of Hope campaign with Lewis, my son, I went to an amazing individual and I said, listen, I'm thinking about doing this. This is my story of why I want to do this. Would you like to come on the journey in some shape or form? You know, I never ask for money because that's an insult. I always ask for resource. And the first thing that I ask of anybody is can I have your intellectual capability? Can you give me, you know, your really expertise of what you're doing? Can you come on my team as a creative director? Can you come on as a marketing ambassador, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you have an incredible story, magic happens around it.
The other book I've been reading recently, and I'd be interested in your views on this, is to do with functional medicine and this idea of the difference between chronological aging and biological aging. And although it's inevitable that we all get older chronologically, it's not at all inevitable that we have to age in a way that society thinks of aging, getting creaky and so on. And if and again, it's a mental and physical thing. Absolutely. If you're doing the right things mentally and physically, you can stay pretty much young for a very, very long time.
Yeah, absolutely, Patrick. I mean, the Japanese are incredible, advocates of this, to be fair. You know, they practice their fenshi and they do all of their amazing, they eat correctly and they get good sleep. And they look after themselves. I think the average age of Japanese person death is somewhere in the high 80s, I think it is. You're as old as you feel, effectively. And if you follow regimes and exercise and mental wellness as well is important, you know, you can actually keep going as long as you want. You can't be as fast and as strong as you are because your body obviously deteriorates as you get older. And you have to set your expectations a little lower. Because I'm never going to row across the ocean as fast as the Ambrose boys did. I mean, they were just absolutely athletes personified. And of course, there were younger soloists in the fleet as well, which did much, much better from an athletic point of view. But you can still achieve. I mean, I think the oldest person in the marathon on Sunday was 90 years of age, and he successfully completed the marathon. He wasn't the slowest. So 90 years of age, and he ran the London Marathon. Quite incredible. So, you know,
it's me immortals though, Bernie. What's your top tip for midlife thriving?
I think really that the best tips I can give to anybody is try and find fulfillment. It's not happiness. If you're fulfilled as an individual, you can achieve anything you want in life, to be fair. And it doesn't revolve around material wealth, you know. And because I've given virtually all of my wealth away, because you know, you only need one hoodie, you know, one cap. It's a question of how you feel inside here. Can you go to bed at night time and can you feel fulfilled about that you've actually done everything you possibly can to help others? And by helping others actually gives you that fulfillment. And I'm very fortunate from that point of view that I've had that for the last 40 years. I've helped, hopefully, thousands of people around the world with what we've done with our work. And, you know, I can actually have a nighttime sleep well, knowing that we've done that. And we continue to do that with this campaign as well. So being fulfilled is a great way of actually extending how you feel and how you actually last within your life as well. And it takes that stress away from you. There's a huge amount of pressure in the world of stress and we get very anxious about performance and so on and so forth. And I think sometimes it's great to take a step back from that. And that's what this row has done. This row has basically reset my value system with about what I value in life now more than ever before. So you know, I'm in the twilight of my life now and coming to the end of my charitable career. And I look back and reflect and think, yeah, the things I've done have been good, but now it's time for me and it's time for my family and it's time to go in a different direction to see if I can help in different ways now.
And your lovely dog too, is it Murphy?
Yeah, I've got a beautiful Welsh collie called Murphy. He's just sensational. I just love him to bits. I mean, dog therapy, as you know, Michelle, is just absolutely amazing. You know, they're the greatest listeners on the planet.
Absolutely.
They give you so much joy. At times they're frustrating, but hey, they're dogs after all, aren't they?
Yeah, same as kids, though. It's like having
a little thing. Yeah.
If you don't answer you back.
Yeah, so true.
Talking about talking. But yeah, in terms of next steps then, Bernie, before we close off, is there anything in particular you want to promote or anything you want to get out there?
Yeah, not particularly promote, Michelle. It's just that you know, if we're coming up to half term in England on the 26th of May, the kids break up for a week for half term. The Boat of Hope is in four phases. We've pulled our boat 370 miles. We've been around the country with the boat. Oh, hello, Mef. He's with me here now. Come on, Mef. Up. There you go. There he is.
Oh, hello, Murphy. Oh, look at that. I've got to take a picture. Can I take a picture? Love it.
I think he misses me, really.
We'll have to compete.
Hello, darling. Yeah, you have to get your
dog. I can't see him. He's gone. I don't know if I got it.
What's this?
There he is.
There you go.
So, I think I got it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's waiting for his afternoon walk, I think, Patrick. So, not to promote at all, but we have an amazing exhibition ending the campaign coming up on the 27th of May. We have the Boat of Hope exhibition. It's at Liverpool Anglican Cathedral. It's open for a week, and we want all the mums and dads and all the kids to come. It's free to come in. If anybody hasn't been to the Liverpool Anglican Cathedral, which is the biggest cathedral in Europe, by the way, and it's got a brand new bishop. So Paul's just giving up, handed over the baton to the next bishop. Come and see the amazing cathedral. It's a fantastic afternoon out. But more importantly, we're going to be there for a week. So my boat that went across the Atlantic is going to be on display with huge amounts of images and pictures from the children that contributed to the boat itself. We've also got mental health workshops for young children as well throughout the whole of the week. And all of this will be coming out shortly through the marketing team at the cathedral. We've also got Bernie and Boaty the play, which from our best-selling number one book is now being made into a play by the students at Gattaca School in Liverpool. They're going to be performing the play three or four times during the week, which is terrific. So come and have a lot of fun. Come and see the boat that I actually rowed 3,500 miles across the ocean. She's going to be on display. Come and see the amazing artwork that the kids have put on it as well. And it's an opportunity as well. We'll have some of our mental health and well-being team there as well. And there's some other great initiatives happening as well. You can put a message in the bottle, what we call. You're going to have a huge bottle there where you can put a message of hope in. And all of those messages are going to be put into a book called the Book of Hope. So you can contribute to the book as well. It's just going to be a fabulous week.
Oh, Bernie, it sounds absolutely incredible. A little shout out to Natalie as well. Natalie Reeves.
The person that is Natalie Reeves Billing. Yeah. Oh, look at that dog.
One of two. I'm getting my phone out again. Thousands of pictures on here of the dogs.
Oh, absolutely gorgeous. He or she?
It's that a she one. With her Maasai collar.
Oh, of course. Hey. Yeah, there you go. So I've got those on my wrist, of course.
But yeah, so and the book was also narrated by, did I read Mel from the Spice Girls?
The book, Bernie and Boaty, available on Amazon. And I'll give you a plug, there it is there.
I love it.
So it's by Natalie Reeves Billings, illustrated also by an amazing lady called Lisa Williams.
Yeah.
It's just been made into a cartoon trailer with the amazing team at King Bee Animation in London. They've come on board because they love our story. And we reached out to Melanie C, and we reached out to an amazing actor called Sasha Dewan. So Melanie is basically narrated it for us along with Sasha. who is an amazing actor that's been in Line of Duty and Doctor Who and so on and so forth. Incredible actor. Both those guys have given us their voice artistry for free. And you can see the trailer on our website as well, which is just absolutely incredible.
Bernie, honestly, I can't thank you enough. Patrick, do you have anything to add just before I just do a quick close, or is there anything you wanted to...
Just to say, Bernie, you're an inspiration to all of us. So I'm sorry to hear you're saying you're coming to the... You described it as the end of your charitable career, whatever, however you...
I doubt that.
Keep going. Yeah, oh, thank you. Thank you, Patrick.
And thank you also for giving some our midlife as well as the younger generation conversation, which is clearly at the heart of our talk today, but obviously giving us midlifers a bit of a kick in the backside as well, you know, to really embrace midlife and not, you know, spiral, make it an excuse to stop enjoying life.
The act of getting up off the sofa is the biggest step you can take towards actually making a difference.
Loving that, Bernie, thank you. And also obviously we've shone a light on the issues around young people's mental health. That is the whole of your campaign, and you're a shining example, actually, not just through the endeavors, but the way you talk about collaborations and community and using creative thinking to really make magic happen, as you say. And get to that younger generation and to let everybody know it's all our responsibilities to make that change, to change the language around it and get everybody talking about it. So thank you for that. And thank you for your being so open as well. I know it was an incredibly tough experience. I mean, I'm using the word tough, it's not the right word. I can't even think of the word of what you went through. But as you say, life-changing. And I really hope that you now have the chance to embrace the simple things in life and you know, be with those who near and dear and your lovely dog and your beautiful family. And keep walking on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Bye.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Talk On to Walk On podcast, which is just one part of our wider offer. Our mission is to remind the world that conversations should never be underestimated, but we also know that many conversations need a lot of courage and confidence. That's why Patrick and I have created Elevate Your Mindset under the Talk On to Walk On brand. If you think you, your team, or your students would enjoy working with us to walk on in life with confidence, then go to our website, talkontowalkon.com. You'll learn more about us, our coaching, mentoring, and talks offer. You can also follow Talk On to Walk On Instagram, Facebook and YouTube. Finally, taking a moment to rate, review and subscribe or even sponsor our podcast will really help us spread our power of conversation message. Remember, the simplest act can have the largest impact. So let's connect, have a conversation, and you never know where it will lead.